pack one, Occam's Razor. This is the story of a family that had one theory about how to explain their lives. And then, at some point, that theory came to seem inadequate. It did not seem to explain the data and evidence before them. And they switched to a different theory. Chris Beam tells the story from Los Angeles.
David Palladino grew up in an Italian family in an Italian neighborhood west of Chicago. It was the kind of place where, in the early 70s, all the kids wore Italian colors, ate Italian beef and sausage from the corner store, and threw money at the Virgin Mary statue at the Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel. But while David is Italian, too, he has many childhood stories about things people said to him that just didn't make any sense. In Sunday school, the other kids called Dave Chocolate Bar and Blackie. People asked him who his real father was. When he went into stores, the clerks would sometimes follow him around as if he was going to steal something. When David was 10, his family moved into a townhouse in a more integrated area. Dave went out to play in a nearby playground.
This kid was there playing. He was, you know, a young black kid, and he starts talking to me, and, you know, he was much more outgoing, you know, than I was. He's asking me questions, and he's like, oh, do you curse, you know, and stuff. I'm like, no, I don't swear. My mom would kill me, you know. So, and he's like, yeah, well, I do. I don't care. So we're, like, having a good time, and I was like, yeah, you want to see my, you know, place? He's like, yeah. So, you know, we walk. It's, like, you know, a minute away, and so we're walking around the backyard area. There's, like, these tall hedges, and then there's the sliding glass door. So as we walk around these tall hedges into the backyard, my two sisters are coming out, Lori and Sherry. And so we walk around the corner, and he stops dead in his tracks. He's like, what them white girls doing in your house? And I was like, white girls, those are my sisters. And he's like, your sisters? And I'm like, yeah. And then all of a sudden, my mom comes out, and my dad's like right behind us, like, oh, Davey, who's your friend? And he's like, who's that? I said, oh, that's my mom. And he's like, your mom? And then my dad is right there. And he's like, I'm like, oh, and that's my dad. He's like, your dad? And he, like, looks at me, and then he looks at them, and he's like, oh, man. And he left. He left. Strangely enough, like, we all had, like, a little laugh about it. And then it was just like, everybody went their own direction, and nobody talked about it. But, you know, in retrospect, looking back on it, it's like, there was probably something there to be discussed, you know, and that put me in more mystery, I guess, about, oh, this is, well, yeah, I guess I am different.
Carol and I met in high school. She was in Provenzano and I was Palladino, so we were three seats apart in homeroom.
This is Dave Palladino's father, David Palladino Sr.
Big snowfall in 1967, we were at a party, and we were at some kid's basement, and there was music playing, and, you know, we met down in the basement, we talked for about an hour, and we went out and played in the snow, and then we went back downstairs and made out. And then after that, it was, you know, we were boyfriend and girlfriend for end of sophomore year, junior year, senior year.
David and Dave's mom, Carol, went to high school in a neighborhood on Chicago's west side called Maywood. In 1968, their junior year, race riots broke out in their school, making national headlines. Kids were pulling guns on each other, and the National Guard was called in. During this time, David and Carol were dating. They didn't participate in the riots. In fact, Dave was vice president of his senior class, and Carol was a cheerleader, and they were both involved in the student leadership's efforts towards racial harmony.
We were trying to, you know, mix the races a bit as far as getting along and meet each other. Where before, it would just be all white people, you know, at our parties, and black kids would all have their parties, but we actually had some crossover things going on where black students were coming into our parties. And I remember we had some black kids come to one of our guys' houses one night, and they taught us, like, how to do the boogaloo dance and all this and so, at that time. So I remember dancing the boogaloo.
Actually, the role that I played at the high school, I was on, in quotes, cross-section committee.
This is Dave's mom, Carol.
Which were blacks and whites, and we were supposed to come up with new ways to try to bring some semblance of normalcy into the high school, like, you know, kind of make it so that there wasn't a problem between blacks and whites. I I started hanging out more with the girls that hung out with the with black people. That's the best way I think I can say it. And so what would happen after basketball games was we wouldn't go hang with the white guys. We'd go find out where the party where the black guys were. And, you know, and for me, it was seeing a different culture. I can remember it then because these gals grew up differently than I grew up. And so it was just me having a different level of understanding. And, of course, being the liberal that I was then, you know, it was like this all felt right.
The big word was that some of the cheerleaders were sleeping with the basketball team. And then I had several people come up to me and tell me that Carol had, you know, was kissing some of the players and other things were going on. But I knew something had happened, but I didn't know what had happened.
It was just dangerous fun for me, okay? And then somebody, and I'm not sure what or how it happened, but somebody had seen me hanging out with a bunch of black kids after a basketball game. And it was my mother's brother, my Uncle Frankie, that had heard it from one of his friends. I think it was Tony Fioravanti or something. But anyway, he told my Uncle Frankie, and my Uncle Frankie told my mom and dad. And my mom and dad then said, "What are you doing hanging out with black kids? They're going to call you a lover. And we can't have that happen." So then I used to sneak around. And, you know, and the easiest way for me to sneak around was make sure that there were other white girls there.
At this point, Carol began seeing one basketball player in particular, Keith Rash, a black student 1 year behind her in school.
I was hanging out with Keith, but I was also hanging out with Dave. You know, I was living the wild life. And, let's see, I screwed around with both of them. That's about as plainly as I can say it. But the problem was, is that also never really understanding how I could get pregnant, when I could get pregnant or anything like that. So we used no form of birth control.
Carol was actually 4 months along before she knew she was pregnant. She got the news from her family doctor a few weeks before Thanksgiving.
All of a sudden, the room just shut. Now, I don't remember if I heard everything he said past that point, because now my mind was, oh my God, who's the father? I had no idea.
No one but Carol knew about Keith, but as Carol started to show, David assumed the baby was his. Now 18 and in their first semester at a nearby college, they decided to get married over the next school break. Carol called her mom with the news. Mom screamed and immediately ran next door to gather Carol's grandparents, and then across the street to get her aunt and uncle. Within hours, everyone was assembled and the patriarchs, David's father and Carol's father, had driven to the college to pick up the kids. Her mother had an announcement. There would be no delaying this marriage. They were to get their blood tests and rings the next day, the wedding dress the following day. And they'd be married by the end of that weekend by the parish priest. Carol says they were both in shock.
Okay, so then Dave says, you know, God bless him, really. The truth is, to try to stand up to my parents, he said, but that's not what we planned. We want to wait, and we want to get married over Thanksgiving. My dad, he said, what do you mean you want to wait? He said, what's the matter? Don't you want to marry my daughter? And there was a pound on the table, too. You know, this is the best shotgun wedding I can think of. Totally Italian stuff. So, you know, if I ever thought that I was going to have a moment to confess anything, I knew right then it was gone. Absolutely gone. And, you know, from that moment on became a daily prayer. In my mind, I could see the baby coming out and being black, and then everybody in the room going like this, and then me coming out and trying to tell Dave. So, I go into labor, and I'm petrified, in pain and petrified. And then he comes out, and they show him to me, and he looked white to me. He had a whole bunch of black hair, but what baby didn't have a black hair? He had dark eyes, but what baby didn't have dark eyes? And we had a lot of darkness in our family. But he didn't look black. So I was like, oh, God, thank you, thank you, thank you. First inkling of it was probably when he was born in March. It was probably toward the end of that summer because I was outside a lot with him. And when he was out in the sun, he got darker. And I was like, uh-oh.
At the Mary Student Apartments, we had a little swimming pool out front. And Davey was out, and he was out in the full sun. And he got brown like that. And immediately looked like, you know, he could have been a black kid. You know, it was dark. And then I remember after that, we had gone shopping. I had him in the cart, and we were wheeling him into a store. And this woman came out and followed us out into the parking lot after we were leaving the store. And she says, oh, wait, I wanted to talk to you. And she said, I noticed that you and your wife have adopted an interracial baby. And, you know, my husband and I are thinking of adopting an interracial baby. And I took it aback, like, what are you talking about? So I said, no, you know, no, this is our baby. She said, I know it's your baby, but we're thinking of adopting this interracial baby. She said, no, you don't understand. This is our baby. And she said, oh, well, and then, you know, finally she understood what I was saying, you know, this is my wife and I's child. It's just dark, you know. That was an odd situation.
What did that do in your mind? Did you think about it? Did you interrogate it? Did you?
No. You see, I've had a lot of time to think about it since that, and I think what's interesting is that your mind. If they have a belief system that they put together, and they build their life on that belief system, that it's very hard for that belief system to be shook or changed by facts. So I don't know how to say it, but I had a belief system that he was my son. I saw him born. I was there at the birth. I was there. I was with his mother, and he was my son.
So many times, I can tell you, we'd say the same story to anybody that would say, especially when the two girls came along, and they were so fair. They'd say, well, he doesn't look like the two girls. And we'd say, well, that's because, you know, he's got the olive skin from the family. You know, my grandfather's really olive skinned. And, you know, Dave's mother, she's, you know, German, but she's got this dark black curly hair, and he's got the same dark black curly hair.
You know, I was a science teacher, so I wasn't like really stupid. Okay. But I do know that, you know, our genetic makeup, it's possible that you can have recessive genes and things that are in your system. They might skip a generation or two, and suddenly, you know, somebody looks like somebody that, you know, like three generations ago, they look like someone.
It's like, you know, we're Italian, Palladino.
As David Jr. got older, he was told the same stories inquisitive strangers were told.
You know, and my aunt was kind of dark-skinned over there, and they had black hair, and on my dad's side, they had this curly hair, but I started to get, like, these explainable things, like, oh, I'm dark-skinned Italian, you know, from the southern part of Italy, so there's also Sicilian, you know, the Sicily is right there, and the Moors, and blah, 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 and this, it is what it is.
Until his teens, Dave's family moved a lot, and he says every move was torture. His two sisters would just be asked the regular questions, like, where are you from, and what music do you like? But Dave would be asked, who's your real dad, and were you adopted? So Dave learned to preempt the interrogations. He started wearing t-shirts with slogans like, proud to be Italian, or another Italian masterpiece. And he would announce his heritage to anyone within moments of an introduction. And it wasn't just Dave. The whole family was in denial. Here's his mom.
As David got older and his face started changing more, etc., and I dared to open up my yearbook and saw Keith and then saw David, I was like, oh, God, and then closed it shut and said, I'll never look at that again.
When he was 12, Dave and his family moved from Chicago to an upper-middle-class suburb of Los Angeles. and things went pretty smoothly there. Dave turned out to be a great football player, had a lot of friends and girlfriends, and after the initial surge of questions, issues of race or ethnicity or what are you just didn't come up too much. After high school, things got harder. His college, he says, was extremely white, and he just began to feel different. By now, he looked decidedly biracial. When he met white girlfriends' parents, they would sometimes shift uncomfortably. He learned the phrase, person of color, and thought of himself as both a white person and a person of color, as if there were such a thing. If you saw David on the street, there's no way you'd think he was white. You'd think biracial or Puerto Rican or Dominican. He's very cute, with tight, soft, curly hair and light, mocha-colored skin. By his mid-20s, David was starting to become an actor and go out on auditions, and the roles he was up for were almost always black or Latin men. One weekend, when he was in his late 20s, David took a trip to Chicago with one of his college friends, Aaron. They spent some time visiting David's family, they stayed downtown, they partied. And on their last night in Chicago, after David and Aaron had been drinking till 4 in the morning, they finally pulled up to their hotel.
We get out of the cab and there's a homeless guy there. And he's a black man, and he's probably in his 40s or something. And he's like, ask for some money, and I think I give him a dollar or something. And Aaron gets out money like he's going to give it to him. And then he's like, well, I want to give this to you, but I want to tell you something, you know. And kind of launches into this thing about, you know, as long as you don't use this to, use drugs or to do something. And, you know, starts giving him a little pep talk, he thought, a pep talk. And, you know, but to me it was like insulting. You know, the guy, I could just see the guy's, like, you know, whole demeanor, just like, oh, man, this guy. And we got in the elevator to go upstairs. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, he's like, what do you mean? I said, give the guy a dollar, give the guy a dollar. You know, give him your, you know, viewpoint. He's like, well, if I'm going to give the guy a dollar, I'm going to say something. I said, you're, what, a 27-year-old white guy who grew up in a, you know, predominantly white area? I said, I don't know his life, but you haven't lived his life. You know, he's a 4-year-old black guy who's living on the street now. Who knows what the heck he's done? But, well, look at, when you see me, what do you see, Aaron? And it started to become a very heated and passionate discussion. And I said, look at me, you know, dark skin, blah, blah, blah. What do you see? And he's like, he started to get to my point, and I just blurted out. I said, I don't know if my mom screwed some black guy or some Mexican guy. I said, but this is me. I have a different reality.
And when that came out of your mouth, what did
that
you...
That came out of my mouth like, you know, I don't know how to even describe it. You know, it's just one of those things where you just like, did I just say that?
So David had to talk to his mom, but he was terrified. Terrified of unraveling a whole family built on the premise of one mom, one dad. Even though they'd gotten divorced years before, this seemed like a cataclysmic rewriting of history. So he waited 2 whole years and tried not to think about it. And then, one morning, he drove to his mom's house without telling her why. When he got there, David realized he had no prepared script. So he exchanged a few pleasantries and he plunged. He said simply, I need to know where I come from. Carol paused, looked at him, and responded, and you deserve to know.
In that moment, you know, I don't know, it's like a lifetime happened, and then it was just like, okay, and she said, Dave Palladino is not your biological father. The next thing, please. and she said, and your father is a man by the name of Keith Rash, who we went to high school with, and he's black. And then my mom said, no surprise to you.
With those words, Dave said it was like a symphony surged through his brain. It was a breakthrough and a relief, and contrary to his mom's fears, David wasn't angry with her at all. He felt like he wasn't emotionally ready to know the truth, after struggling personally in college and in the years after, until that very day. He actually felt grateful she waited. He was, though, worried about what David Sr. would do. Turns out, Carol said, David Sr. had known for 9 years. She had told him before their divorce and begged him not to tell his son. David Sr. wasn't surprised. He said he always knew somehow, below the surface of consciousness. There's a principle in science called Occam's razor. The idea is, if there are two possible explanations for some phenomenon, the simpler one is the better one to use. This principle goes back to Aristotle, who said, essentially, nature operates in the shortest way possible. And in our daily lives, this is how we usually explain the world to ourselves. But the simple explanation isn't always the one we want. The Paladinos couldn't accept the plain answer that Dave had a different father. They had to create something far more complex. What started as Carol's small secret simply grew too big to untangle. When David was born, she believed he was her husband's son, and when David Sr. believed that too, months and even years later, she thought to herself, why shatter that relationship? She was so busy with three kids, she could often forget about David's coloring, sometimes even convincing herself that he might be her husband's anyway, that maybe there was something to that recessive gene idea. David Sr. did a similar dance, pushing disturbing questions out of his mind because subconsciously he wanted his family, his world, to remain intact. And the kids, like all kids, craved security, so they kept their questions buried too. It wasn't that love was blind. It was that everyone was blinded by the fear of losing love. No one wants to disturb the fragile bonds that keep us standing. Dave says a lot of people don't get this, don't understand why his family didn't always know he was black.
That's what people may not understand. Well, yeah, Dave, well, I could tell he's black, or he's dark, or he's this. You know, those things are obvious. Or, yeah, I knew all the whole time. Like, you know, go screw yourself. Because the fact of the matter is when you're in a situation and all you know is, you know, he's your dad and he's your son, and, you know, I have support and I have love, you know, you're not looking to try and ruin that. Or to, you know, you may have some questions. We may have been in denial. Not may have, we were, or whatever, to a certain degree. But you know what you know.
As you might expect, David wanted to meet his biological father. He started looking up Keith Rash's and telephone directories and calling them up. After months of reaching confused guys of all races, David finally tracked him down to an address on an Edgware Street in Memphis, Tennessee. No phone number available. David then avoided the issue again for 6 months, until he found himself in Florida on a job and decided to rent a car and drive 12 hours across 5 states in the rain. He found Edgware Street a little after 9 on a May morning.
So I went to the front door. I knock on the front door. And I hear, like, around the corner, the side door open. Can I help you? Oh, man. Of course, my heart jumps into my throat. And I was like, what am I doing? And there's a man, you know, holding the screen door open. As soon as I come around the corner and I see this man, I'm like, oh, my God. If that is not my father, I don't know who is. And I said, I said, I'm looking for Keith Rash. And he says, you got him. Who are you? And I said, well, my name's David Paladino. And he looks at me. It's the strangest look on his face. And he said, didn't I go to high school with you? And I'm like, no, not exactly. I said, maybe remember my mom, Carol Provenzano. And I'll never forget it. He's got his one hand, like, keeping the door propped open. And he starts to turn in, like, to go in. And while he's turning in, he says, come on in. When he turned to go in and I saw his legs and his shoulders and just almost the way he walked, because he had a bum knee, all the times that I looked for family members, oh, do they look like me? Is that like me? Or is that... All of a sudden, I was looking at, like, my legs.
Keith Rash moved to Memphis about 18 years ago and now works a security night shift at the FedEx hub. A few months ago, David and I went to Memphis to visit Keith. He's a gregarious, smiley guy, eager to please and excited that he has this brand new son. His apartment is almost entirely bare, save for a dining room table, a bed, and some empty boxes.
and framed photographs everywhere. Underneath the bed and in the closet, there are more pictures, boxes and boxes of them, in albums and in bags.
Now this guy here, you see the resemblance?
Yes, absolutely.
But yeah, you know, I think that him and Dave look a lot alike.
They do.
Yeah, this is Henry Rash. He's from.
In the time since his first trip to Memphis, Dave has been welcomed into the Rash family. He's met his half-brother and the rest of the family at a reunion in Chicago. He's making plans to spend some time with his grandmother in the next few months in Los Angeles. Keith gushes and fawns over Dave, bragging about his acting gigs and comparing his good looks to his other son, Shelley. He says they're practically identical. Shelley was raised by his mom across the country, though he would visit Keith sometimes. Keith shows us photos and tells us stories about his past. There are a lot of people who have died or who he's lost touch with, and he alludes to difficult years and a few run-ins with the law. Now, he says, he lives through his two sons, and he doesn't have many friends or much of a life in Memphis. He's more stable, mostly watches television, has a few drinks after work. Dave also brought pictures to show Keith. He pulls out a baby picture and some kid shots with his sisters.
Got a couple here when I was just a little man. Ooh-wee. Yeah, I tell you, you do look a little Afro-American on that, honey. Compared to, yeah.
We decide to go out for some barbecue. Keith lets Dave borrow his special Year of the Dragon necklace and keeps clapping him on the back. David is a little shyer, more watchful. On the way, I get this glimpse of what Keith is like. His personality is huge. He's funny and charming. He won't call me my first name Chris or my last name Beam, but Beamer. It's hard not to like him. While we're out, the waitress seems to take a shine to Keith, and he, slowly easing his eyes over the rim of his whiskey glass, tries to pick her up. Right in front of his son and a radio reporter with a foot-long microphone.
Look, so that means you're going to be busy later. See, the reason I asked, let me just cut to the chase,
right.
Okay?
Hits
we're going
point.
Back by my house.
Okay.
I'm taking off from FedEx tonight.
Okay.
And I thought it'd be nice if you might come by and keep just going here.
Why not?
We go back to Keith's apartment and listen to music, drink some beers, and hang out. Keith raps along with Tupac. Dave, hilariously, practices his trained ballet moves to the beat in the middle of the living room. The waitress calls and flirts, but never shows up.
It gets worse.
Keith's fine with the fact that he didn't raise Dave. He implies that he might not have always been the best influence himself. And if he has a problem with the fact that Dave grew up in a white world with no strong black figures to guide him, he doesn't let on. He says Carol and David provided Dave with the strength of character to handle it.
Do you feel weird that they didn't tell him that of his racial heritage at all, that he grew up thinking he was white and then struggling with that difference?
No, because it's got to go back to the family, you know. If you got something that's been that deep-rooted for so long, why uproot it?
For his part, Dave has had 2 years now to adapt to the fact that he's black, and he's still adjusting. It's awkward sometimes. He says there are some things he never learned or got used to.
Because just the mechanics of not ever really being around a whole lot of black people, that when I'm ever around, you know, more than probably 3 or maybe 4 or like a bigger group, that I'm not like I'm crawling in my skin, but that I'm just not as solid as I am sitting here right now.
So you're nervous?
It's not like I'm sitting there the whole time kvetching, you know, and be like, oh my God. but I'm like, I'm just not as settled all the time. You know, I'm not as present or as centered as I am, like, sitting here talking. I think that somebody who's known all their life that they're half this and half that is probably has that more of an identity, maybe.
What's amazing about this story is that nobody's mad. Keith's not bitter that he had no access to his son. David's not mad at his mother and never has been. Even Dave Sr. isn't angry. He still feels just as much David's father as he ever did. Which brings us back to Occam's razor, the principle that the simplest explanation for something is the best one.
In a family, the explanation that seems simplest can switch over time. When David was young, the simpler thing to believe was that his parents were his parents and his family was his family, and that he was a Paladino. As he got older, that story got harder to maintain, and the other explanation, that Keith was his father, became the simplest for everyone. And when the family shifted from one story to the other, they didn't get caught up in issues of race and paternity and lying and betrayal. When the truth came out, the truth that the whole family was fearing for so long, it didn't spark any great trauma at all. It just put people at peace.